what's crime might mean in the conventional criminal justice system, it means something very, very specific in restorative justice. It says that crime breaks human relationships, that what it does is destroy the peace and security felt in community, that it makes it impossible for victims and offenders alike to continue living in peace and security unless those harms have been healed. In short, what restorative justice says is that the harms caused by crime have to be healed through peace.
So the video you just watched is a clip from a 25-minute video titled The Spiritual Roots of Restorative Justice. The speaker is Dr. Michael Hadley, who tells us that criminal acts break the relationship between individuals and undermine the cohesion necessary for society to function. The concept of spirituality and connection are synonymous in my mind. Spirituality is about the emotional connection we feel with nature, with society, with one another, the connection we feel with our own emotions, and the connection we feel with whatever we call our highest power. There is a spiritual quality in all human relationships. That's the nature of the universe that we live in. Our experience of life is partly determined by how we react to the events that happen to us. The message of the sermon that I'm offering today may be troublesome for some of you. It may offend some of you, and I apologize for that. If you've been profoundly hurt by a criminal act, you may find the message of restorative justice is not what you want to hear. In my own life, I've been spared the worst. The worst things that have happened to me in relation to the criminal justice system have been theft of money or possessions. In one case, I had the brake lines in my car cut, but fortunately, they recovered before I got very far, and it didn't turn out to be a serious incident. I chose the topic of restorative justice for today because November 20th and 27th is Restorative Justice Week around the world. And there's a significant national conference on this topic in Halifax that starts today. Actually, I have a bit of a confession. I was kind of looking forward to an easy ride this morning. I have a good friend, Hugh Kierkegaard, who is a regional chaplain with the Correctional Services of Canada. And I talked with him about coming to present a service, and I would just kind of sit back and help out. But unfortunately, because of this conference, he has a specific commitment this morning at his own church. So rather than coasting on the coattails of a colleague, I had to get busy and think hard about restorative justice. The first recognized case of restorative justice in Canada was documented in Elmira, Ontario, 1974. Two young offenders had vandalized a total of 22 properties, inflicting damages that amounted to less than $3,000 in total. They'd done things like slashing tires on parked cars or breaking windows in houses. The assigned probation officer, and significantly, a Mennonite prison support worker, asked the judge for permission to arrange for the two offenders to meet with the victims that they had vandalized in order to see if reparations could be made. The judge, as would be expected at the time, initially rejected their proposal. It just wasn't a precedent for doing this in the justice system. But later, to their surprise, he reversed themselves. In fact, he gave them the responsibility for carrying out what they had promised to do. So the probation officer and the Mennonite support worker went with the offenders, knocking on doors, on the doors of the victims, asking them to describe how they had been affected and what, if anything, they could do to make amends. In the end, the offenders raised the money to cover checks that were delivered to each of the victims. In a nice summary of the results, an elder woman whose tires had been slashed told the young men that when they saw her on the street, they no longer needed to cross her. They no longer needed to cross to the other side. concept of restorative justice has spread around the world. We can be proud of Canada's leading role in the movement, though we have a long way to go, and in particular, the role in Nova Scotia. Nova Scotia is seen as a leading jurisdiction in Canada for implementing restorative justice principles in the criminal justice system. To date, it's been largely something available to young offenders, but if you're listening to the news in the last couple of weeks ago, they announced they were extending the program to include adults. Before we delve into the topic of restorative justice, we need to explore what we mean by justice itself. In our second principle, our congregation's covenant to affirm and promote justice, equity, and compassion in human relations. Just what do we mean by justice? Justice has a very large cultural component. What we may see as self-evident principles of justice were not always the norm. Tracing justice in the Western European tradition, we can see that the ancient Greeks and the Jewish culture agreed that justice came from the gods, or from God. A criminal act was an offense against God, a sin. Later, when the Roman emperors and other kings claimed divine authority, justice became a matter of righting wrongs against the state, as represented by the ruler. During the Enlightenment of the 17th century, thinkers like John Locke argued that justice should be based on natural law, that there were rights and values inherent in human nature that can be universally understood through reason. Others argued that justice was based on a social contract. Still others on a utilitarian goal of a system that had the best results for the most people. Or that justice was primarily related to how wealth was acquired and how wealth was distributed. That's a topic that we think Lars might be addressing later in the month. Behind all of this Western thought was the concept of personal property. The cultural nature of justice systems is brought, the cultural nature of justice systems is brought clearly into focus when we think of Western European ideas of property rights versus the indigenous North American culture for whom the idea of individual property rights was anything but just. Another example of cultural bias, our system vigorously punishes so-called blue-collar crime while ignoring, to a large extent, white-collar crime. Our Western European justice systems have evolved towards retribution. Retribution is about the punishing of the criminal for their actions as a way to balance the scales of justice. This principle can be justified on the basis that the punishment acts as a deterrent for criminal acts. But one underlying motive for this system has always been the less worthy goal of vengeance. My sermon this morning on the theme of letting go is entitled Letting Go of Retribution. Letting go of the idea that the criminal must always be punished, and that somehow that's sufficient to restore a balance in society. The alternative to retributive justice is restorative justice. An idea based on the idea that crime is the result of a breakdown in human relationships. It's not an offense against the state. It's an offense against individuals, the community, and the relationships in the community. Restorative justice emphasizes the healing of victims, the meaningful accountability of offenders, and the involvement of community. Our present retributive justice system is often dehumanizing. It is focused on expediency, on legal technicalities. The offender frequently never actually speaks in court, or maybe once, just asks the question, do you plead guilty or innocent? And any show of emotion in the courtroom is discouraged by law professionals. The lawyers will do all the talking, thank you very much. And the victims have been completely excluded from the process until recently, when victim impact statements have been allowed before sentencing in some cases. But victim impact statements all too often are more about shaming and retribution, about maximizing sentencing. much more so than they are about healing relationships. The true nature of human community is messy. It's difficult and it's challenging. It's hard work. But it's the work that we're called to do. In a modern society, we try too often to isolate ourselves from that messiness. And the criminal justice system is one of the ways we insulate ourselves. My favorite example of the avoidance of this messiness is a classic case of someone who's kept awake by the barking of a neighbor's dog. In our society, it's completely acceptable to call the police, make a complaint, and expect that the police will deal with the problem. How much more messy to go next door and talk to the neighbor about their dog and the effect that barking is having on your life. Our present justice system is based on identifying what law has been broken, who broke the law, and what the appropriate punishment should be. Restorative justice is based on the investigation of what happened and who has been affected and what can be done to restore a right relationship and repair the damage done. In this understanding, restorative justice has applications that go well beyond the legal system. The original case of the young man that I talked about who did $3,000 in vandalizing acts seems pretty trivial now. I want to share a Canadian example with you from the other end of the spectrum.
2 weeks before my children's 5th birthday, I found myself standing in the emergency room of a local hospital, watching Dr. defibrillator pads in his hand, desperately trying to resuscitate my husband. Just an hour before, he and two friends had left our quiet New Year's party to go check on the home of a vacationing neighbor whose son had decided to host a party of his own. Something. Autopsy results revealed that Bob had died from multiple kicks to the head. But the information really stopped there. A code of silence descended over the small community we lived in. None of the 200 young people that were at that party gave the police the information that they needed to move forward with their investigation. The media were on my doorstep immediately, shoving the microphone in my face saying, "What do you want to see happen to the person that did this?" My children had just lost their father. I didn't want them to lose me in the process. If I had responded frankly, the way society expected me to, filled with hatred, filled with vengeance, what kind of person, what kind of parent was I going to become? Absolutely, I wanted answers. Absolutely, I wanted somebody to be accountable. But I also wanted to know that my children were going to be okay, that my community was going to be okay, and that included whoever was on the other side of this horrible tragedy. It was 5 years before Ryan Aldridge was arrested and charged in connection with my husband's death. The police called to tell me they were ready to make the arrest, and I told them I was on my way. What are you talking about? Why would you want to meet the person that killed your husband? Leave that to the police, to the system. I said, I need to sit down with him. I need to speak to him face to face. I need to understand what was going on in his life to make him capable of doing what he did. I need him to understand what's been going on in our lives. I need to tie him in. 16 hours after Ryan was arrested, I was back in that community, sitting in a small interrogation room about to meet the young man that killed my husband. I thought my heart would come out my mouth. I expected some kind of monster to walk through the door. Not a young man that could be my son, your son, somebody's best friend. He sat across from me, slumped over, sobbing. I handed him ball after ball of tissue, and it was all I could do not to get out of my seat, to cross over the other side of the room, and to give him a hug.
That was Katie Hutchison. She's Canadian from British Columbia. An excerpt from a much longer talk on the TED series. If you Google Katie Hutchison, you'll find it. She and Ryan Aldridge, subsequently, who was the murderer, subsequently established a relationship that lasts to this day. Ryan was eventually released from prison, found employment, got married, raised a family. Ryan and Kate and Katie have traveled the world together, spreading the message of restorative justice. Systems of restorative justice around the world have been heavily influenced by three traditions. The early initiatives were led by individuals embracing a Christian worldview. The Mennonite Church in particular has been at the forefront of this movement, and is so today. Two of the values that resonate especially well with Christian thought are reconciliation and forgiveness. The second major influence on the justice system has been the indigenous peoples of North America and elsewhere. New Zealand has been very active in this as well. In indigenous societies, crime was always seen as harm against the entire community. Elders had a leadership role in the resolution process, and the entire community was involved. In indigenous societies, no one is disposable. We can't say that about our own society. In indigenous societies, the goal is always to care for and to reintegrate the offender. The idea of a healing circle is central to the processes in indigenous societies and is now mainstream in restorative justice movement. And the third major influence on the growth of restorative justice is the rise in the influence of women in general. Female voices have been changing leadership styles, encouraging more egalitarian, more nurturing, more compassionate processes. The expression of emotion and personal feelings are valued more in our society now than in the past. And it's a direct result of the increasing role of women outside of the home. The most dramatic local application of restorative justice has been the work done around the 12 men at Dalhousie Dental School, who maintained an offensive, misogynistic Facebook site. The university resisted calls to expel the students and bring criminal charges. This would have been the traditional retributive approach to punish the offender and hope that would deter future offenses. That Facebook page at Dalhousie University, however, was clearly just the tip of a very messy iceberg. The 12 men involved were the product of a society and a social system that perverts healthy human sexuality and promotes unhealthy power relationships between men and women. Those working on the case, it became immediately clear during their initial investigation of the process that the women impacted in the Facebook posts were most interested not in punishing the offenders, but in using this incident to transform their faculty into a safe and healthy learning community. The university chose to follow a restorative justice path that involved a lot more work and discussion and relationship building and rebuilding. So there was months of work done with the offenders and the victims, and the work is continuing today with new students coming into the school. Interestingly, the team that led the restorative justice process said, if there's one innovation to pass on from our experience as facilitators in this continuing process, it would be to highlight the possibility to expand restorative approaches to build healthy communities before there is a crisis to respond to. They're saying that we need to listen to each other deeply and let each other know how we're affected before things become a crisis. So as I near the end of remarks, I'd like to explore how restorative justice might be important here in this small congregation. Restorative justice is a concept that speaks directly to the principles, sources, and traditions of Unitarian Universalism. It speaks to our first principle, the principle of the inherent worth and dignity of every person. When we speak of affirming justice, equity, and compassion in our second principle, the kind of justice we're describing is not one of retribution, but one of restoration. We are a covenant-based religion. Our congregations are united not by creed or dogma, but by our commitment to stay in right relationship with each other. I've been blessed to be your minister over the past 4 years during a time when there have been no major problems or conflicts within the congregation. And I can go further to say that I sleep well at night, believing that there are no such divisions or issues on the immediate horizon. But sooner or later, all congregations have issues that arise. And so I think the recommendation of the facilitators at Dell would be wise to follow. We could highlight the possibilities to expand restorative approaches and to build healthy communities before a crisis is present among us. We're planning a couple of salons early in the new year around topics related to the future of our building and the use of the word church in our name. Both of those can be quite divisive. Both of those can be quite held. Positions on either side can be held quite passionately. I'm not anticipating there could be any major discord over these issues, but they could provide us with an opportunity to sit in a healing circle and to listen carefully to each other, thereby expanding our experience with these restorative approaches. So I ask that we commit as a congregation and as a beloved community that we will always work towards ensuring that we listen carefully to one another, searching for ways to support each other and to build healthy relationships. When problems arise, as they inevitably will, let us not seek to get even or punish or impose our will. May we have the patience and the wisdom to seek, first, to understand what has happened, second, to determine who's been affected and what ways they've been affected, and third, to focus on what we can do to correct injustice on healing relationships. May it be so.